to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 584. My name is Camden Busey. I'm pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois, and I'm ecstatic to be back today. I don't use that adjective very often, but the reason is we have a very special episode. We're having a live Voss group. We're testing out a webinar, and we have a whole bunch of people online participating in this conversation to come, but let me introduce to you the panelists first. We have Dr. Lane Tipton, who serves as professor of biblical and systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Glenside, Pennsylvania. He's also pastor of Trinity OPC in Easton, PA. Hi, Lane. Welcome back. It's great to speak with you.
Camden, as always, it's a delight.
Yeah, it's a special night. It is a Voss group. It's the next installment of Voss group, but not a normal one, because we're also welcoming to the program our dear friend. We have Danny Olinger. Danny serves as the general secretary for the OPC's Committee on Christian Education. Welcome back, Danny. It's great to speak with you, too.
Hey, thanks, Camden.
Yeah, well, Danny was with us, obviously, for the Reform Forum conference back in October, and Danny was a special speaker for our VIP dinner, which we always host the night before the conference begins. So we had a wonderful evening again. This is the second year now that we've gone to a place in Lake Forest, Illinois, called Market House on the Square, and we had a great dinner, a great time of fellowship and conversation, and Danny was able to speak to us about Gerhardus Voss and much of his work and influence. Now, of course, if you don't have it, you need to get a copy. But Danny is the author of this wonderful book showing on the video, Gerhardus Voss, Reformed Biblical Theologian, Confessional Presbyterian, and it's been published by none other than us, by Reformed Forum. And it's a tremendous book. I can't say enough about it. And I know we've been mentioning it a lot and talking about it. I'm trying not to burn the listeners out and talk about the book too much. But we're so thankful that we've sold a tremendous amount of copies. I don't think it's any proprietary info, but Ryan Noah, who's in the stream as well, might be able to give me a thumbs up or thumbs down. But last I checked, we're in the ballpark of 700 to 750 copies that have been sold.
Beautiful.
And sent out. Yeah, I'm getting a thumbs up from Mr.
It's
Noah.
Which is great.
It is. And to think about this wonderful book, which is well worth it and deserving of a title, but I couldn't say more. Now, for other publishers, maybe that's peanuts, insignificant. But if you think about it, the hardcore Voss devotees, people who love Reformed biblical theology, and to think that even after just a couple months, there are that many out there who've been reading the book, and that's just the hardcover that's been going out. I don't think that includes the Kindle copies and the ebook copies. And so we just pray and look to the Lord to spread more and more of this theology around the world. I just shared a photo of a friend of ours, Jim Van Drunen, who is Mark Van Drunen's father. Mark's a board member at Reform Forum. He's a PCA elder out in Hudson, Ohio. But Jim Van Drunen just took a copy of the book to Myanmar and delivered it to a president of the seminary out in Myanmar. And so Voss is making the rounds. And so it's a wonderful thing that we're able to join today and speak about Voss and talk about his influence on some significant theologians, some of our theological heroes. Danny, I love the outline you sent, and we're going to be talking about how Voss has been influential in the lives of many people. We'll talk about Machen, Van Til, Stonehouse, several others. But even before we speak about those people, I'd love for you, Danny, just to share with us how you were introduced to Voss. How did you come to learn about him, and how did you come to fall in love with him?
Yeah, well, I had heard about Voss, but when I went to Westminster Seminary in California, I met Jim Dennison, and he explained Voss to me, and I got very excited about it. But I was also in love with Diane and wanted to come back and marry her. And so I
different kind of love.
Back. Yeah, came back, as Lane knows, I really outkicked my coverage with Diane, but came back to Ohio and looked up Charlie Dennison in Pittsburgh, and he was really the one who taught me everything. And I was thinking about that in preparation for this evening, and that how Charlie came to learn about Voss, and then how Jim came to learn about Voss. Charlie was a Geneva College graduate And he went to a Banner of Truth conference in 1966, and he heard Edmund Clowney. Gerstner was the headliner of the conference, but Clowney really sparked Charlie's interest, and Charlie ended up enrolling at Westminster. And in his first semester, he just so happened to take Dick Gaffin's class on New Testament theology, which would eventually become Dick's class on Acts and Paul. And Charlie was just loved every second of it, and just read everything that Dick put before him from Boss, and totally captured what Boss was saying. So Charlie gets ordained in the OPC in 1972, and he becomes a pastor in Fairton, New Jersey, South Jersey. And he's putting to practice what he learned about Boss, and he's preaching Bossian sermons. And his older brother Jim comes to visit during a holiday, and he hears Charlie preach on Isaiah's Little Apocalypse, chapters 24 through 27. And it blows Jim away. He just can't believe, you know, what he heard, and what Charlie, the Christ-centeredness of the message. And so they're having lunch back at Charlie's house, and Jim's going, "Who are you reading? Was it Young?" And Charlie goes, "No." So Kyle and Delitzsch, "No." And he goes, and you know, anyone who knows Jim Dennison, no one has read more commentaries than Jim. And finally, Charlie just says to him, "I'm just reading the text. I'm just reading the text." And finally, Jim said, you know, asked, "Well, who taught you to read the text like that?" And Charlie, "Well, it's Gerhardus Voss. Read Gerhardus Voss. That's how you learn to read the text like that." And Jim, being passionate, intense like he is, just dove into Voss with a fervor, and himself also became, you know, a great follower of Voss. So I think back of I was thinking of that in regard to how much I love Voss Group on Reform Forum, and that it used to be that you either went to seminary to learn about Voss, and that's what John Frame actually talks about in the Doctrine of Knowledge of God. There's a portion there where Frame talks about that, or you heard someone who was preaching it.
Yeah.
But now to have a Voss Group, it's just so, what you two are doing is so tremendous. And I just love it. And I just a big shout out to you for making that available for a wider audience.
Oh, goodness. Well, you're very kind. Thank you. Thank you for that. But Lane, why don't you can you recollect? I guess first I'd like to ask you, I know we've rehearsed the story before, but just for the sake of this evening, how Voss Group started, and then maybe how this came about in terms of us trying to put it into a podcast.
Oh, well, it started basically about a year after I got to Westminster in 1998. So coming up into 99, I think, is when it started. And it started at Grace Mullen's home. And right before it moved to Grace's, there were some students who were doing some studies in Voss or Gaffin or Murray or something like that. And as the study started moving toward Grace's place, which it did pretty quickly, we decided to just start focusing on things Voss had written. And we studied Grace and Glory, portions of the biblical theology. I believe we did Gaffin's Resurrection and Redemption. Danny and Camden, you both remember, I think things we did more than this, but and it really did develop into something. Once a month on a Friday night, no more than 20 people sitting down, reading through Voss, and having really rich fellowship in the truth as Voss was kind of guiding us and leading us, and we were starting to understand some things together that were just really encouraging. And I'll be honest with you, Camden. I think I've said this before. I don't know if I've ever said it on a Voss Group, but I was really skeptical about doing Voss Group because I didn't think there'd be, you know, a whole lot of people who'd be interested in hearing it. But, you know, you did talk to me and remind me, said, you know, Lane, remember this is Voss we're reading. There, people will they'll want to learn. So, I think the difference between the original Voss group and this one, the one we're doing now online, is that I think we may go into a little bit more detail at points than we did in the past. But the substance of it has stayed just the same because, you know, we're working through Voss's biblical theology. It's been fun.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And then I'd agree where, you know, it's not always sticking explicitly to exactly what Voss said, but trying to understand him from within and applying him to different theological controversies and issues to extend him. But I think the thing that makes me the happiest and the most joyful about Voss Group is the way in which it really has opened Voss up to the non-expert. You know, you don't have to be an initiate through a seminary education or somebody who has spent so many years to read the real technical literature and then try to figure out, you know, how that might apply to preaching and whatnot. So in many ways, we've kind of democratized Voss on accident.
Entirely. That wasn't even my plan. I just wanted to do Voss Group.
Well, right.
That's great.
And you know, it's just the way God uses the technology that it's just more accessible. And that was a problem for me before even moving to seminary, and it was the reason we started Reform Forum to begin with, is where I lived prior to moving to Philadelphia. I didn't have any Reformed people or Reformed churches to go to or Reformed people to speak with. And so I always felt like I was reading and studying in isolation. And then when I finally was able to move out to Westminster, I was having conversations every day, all the time. Probably too many of them, if you talk to my wife. and no, that's true for you too. But then, talking to Jim Cassidy and Jeff Waddington, we were able to sit down, have a conversation and think about this and say, you know what, why don't we record some of these? And there's these things called podcasts now. And they said, well, what's a podcast? It's like an internet radio show. So we can record it, put it online. And what most people might not remember is that you were our very first guest. We didn't do guests for about 20. Yeah. In the first, we didn't do outside guests for about 20 episodes or so. That 20th some weekend on a Friday, we released an episode where you talked about, you want to take a stab at what your first appearance was about? Do you remember?
Well, there have been so many. I'm going to guess it was about Van Til's Theology of the Trinity.
Nope. That was later. Close. It was about the Gaffin Festschrift.
Oh, really? The Gaffin Festschrift?
Because it had just come out.
That's been a good while.
Edited that. So anyway, that just goes to show, you know, Voss's influence extends widely. I know it's reached down to Colombia. I know a lot of people in Japan bought the Kindle edition of the Voss bio. That's great.
Hey, I'm gonna announce this. I don't know if anyone knows it, but I gave a copy. I didn't get Danny to sign it. You know, we're OP and not into that sort of thing. But
Danny signs them.
I know he'd do it. I just didn't want it. But I didn't want it. I gave the book to each Westminster faculty member.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just a beautiful thing.
It's a way to spread it.
Deeply appreciative. In fact, Danny, just today, someone on faculty mentioned how much they appreciated the volume. And I was...
I heard that myself from a faculty member I was having a phone conversation with last week.
That's great.
Yeah, we're glad it's getting around and people are really... really enjoying it and learning. And we're not the only ones. The point of what we're talking about, exactly. It's worth every cent. So get a copy here. But the way I want to connect this is that, you know, obviously we love Voss. I know many of our listeners and the people certainly that are on the program tonight watching and participating love Voss as well. But we're just part of a larger story. Voss has been influential on many theologians. And maybe there was a bit of a quiet time where the Voss's influence might have appeared to kind of dim and wasn't as effective or influential, where we trust we're in something of a renaissance, if we might call it that. But if we go back, we can see Voss's hand and his influence upon many important theologians. And then obviously many of these theologians have in turn influenced many other people in their kind of theological family tree. But Danny, I want to start off by just asking you about some of the basics here. You know, the first person perhaps we can talk about is J. Gresham Machen. I have his portrait right over my head here. He looks down upon me every day as I study the Word. You see, I've got Calvin behind me there. I've got two diplomas, but then Voss Calvin, or Machen Calvin Van Til on the other wall. Yeah, there you go. And we've got Luther on the other side, so I'm well flanked by men who keep me accountable. Danny, what could we say about Voss's influence upon Machen? It's a big question, but how would you say what might be the thing that we can really grasp onto where we really see the fingerprints of Voss on Machen's life and theology?
Yeah, big question. I would go back to the fact that Machen gets to Princeton in 1902, 1903, he doesn't really appreciate Voss. As a matter of fact, from his personal notebooks, it appears that Voss frustrates him greatly. At the end of the biblical theology course, one of the great doodles I've ever seen, gigantic pencil, I flunked Voss. And, it's obvious that he is not enjoying this.
Yeah.
And, so what's really, I think the turning point is Voss had an Easter sermon, and that was Rabboni from John chapter 20. And Machen heard him preach it at Miller Chapel, and Machen writes his mother. And it's quite a letter in which Machen basically says Voss is usually too severely theological for Sunday morning, but that this sermon was nothing less than inspiring. And when you go back and look at that sermon, I know Lane also, I mean, it's one of the great sermons that I've ever read. I can't even imagine hearing it preached. But in it, it's the risen Christ meeting this believer and coming to her in this tenderness of love and reaching out to her, but yet the fact that it's all predicated on the historicity of the event. So Voss shows Machen that there's not this dichotomy between the historicity and that covenantal communion that takes place through the person and work of Christ. And I think that really has an impact upon Machen, that he starts to, I mean, obviously Machen's going through a transition in which he goes to Germany in 1906, and he's with Hermann, and he's thinking through these things. But really, if you start to look at what he's doing later on, and like the origin of Paul's religion, or what is faith, or some of his, you know, obviously Christian liberalism, Machen keeps on coming back to the fact that you do not have to have a separation between history and theology, as the critics are saying, and also that Christ is not that you're not looking at Jesus as a moral reformer or teacher or great mm-hmm. man or example. You're primarily looking at him as the Redeemer, mm-hmm. as the Son of God come in the flesh. And I think it's all seen right there in that sermon. I know that's a lot for a single sermon, but you look at it, and it's one of those sermons where you can't take your eyes off of it.
Yeah. You can get that and read it in Grace and Glory, right? Rabboni's
right
in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, that's tremendous. I mean, Lane, when you read Machen, not just when you see him in the history and you see the things that he did, but when you read Machen, do you see Voss's imprint there as well?
Yeah, you know, I just wrote a little something the seminary asked me to do, which I think every faculty member was asked to write about 1,000-word statement about how Voss had impacted us in given areas in his Christianity and liberalism. Imagine. And I was just struck afresh that when he's talking about the supernaturalism and theocentrism of the kingdom, of which Christ is Lord, the ascended Christ, and lays such great emphasis on that historical transition that occasions resurrection and ascension and so on. I was really struck by the way you can see Machen grasping the, I think Danny says it this way, and I love the way he puts it, the movement away from idea to event. And that event being the actual historical calendar time, crucifixion and glorification of Christ.
Yeah, Machen, obviously a significant person here for us in the OPC especially, but he's a huge figure for American Presbyterianism just in general, and even beyond Presbyterianism. He, in many ways, was the leader of the fundamentalists in the early 20th century, and things changed a lot when he passed away. He died of pneumonia in 1937, just on the New Year's Day, and so the whole course of things changed for that fundamentalist movement. It led to other issues that, that you can read about in a lot of the historians' books that the Committee for the Historian publishes with the OP. One of those things was it really, one of the side effects, at least, perhaps, was that it opened up that the OPC for new faces and new voices that were present, but they it gave them more space to kind of rise to the occasion and take a great theological leadership role. And clearly one of the people that did fill that void was Cornelius Van Til. Van Til, there's an ongoing question, which is how much was Machen in line with Van Til's apologetic? Now, that might sound like a backwards way to ask it, because Machen, of course, was supposed to teach apologetics at Princeton, and we'll just say it didn't work out. And Van Til eventually made his way there and kind of taught as an instructor. But then Van Til, you can read about it in Mether's biography, eventually was called to Westminster Seminary many, many times, but he finally succumbed to the hard recruiting of J. Gresham Machen at the encouragement of Stonehouse and other people. And so the question is, you know, why did Machen want Van Til so bad? Because it appears as if Machen might have been more of an apologist in the old Princeton mode, like a la Warfield and Hodge, but especially Warfield. And so there's an ongoing question, and there's a thesis to be written by somebody. So if somebody's listening and they want to study apologetics the right way, through, you know, the Reformed way, which is more in line with what Van Til was doing, then it would. I'd like to read a dissertation or a thesis on a real, you know, deep study, detailed study on Van Til's apologetic and its influence upon or by or whatever on Machen. The relationship between those two would be really interesting. But I'm going somewhere with this. One is that the influence of Voss on Van Til is even easier to depict than the influence of Voss upon Machen. Would you agree with that, Danny? And where do you, you know, where does that influence on Van Til even start with Gerhardus Voss?
Yeah. Let me go back for just a second.
I got some errors?
Well, Machen, you know, after the Scopes trial and after he was offered the presidency of Bryan University in 1927, was very careful to make sure that he, if the difference, if you, you had to name, you know, a term, he wanted to be called Reformed, and he really didn't like the fundamentalist term, but he thought if it was over against liberalism, if those were the options, you can call him a fundamentalist, but he every day of the week wanted to be called Reformed.
So, that's a good caveat. Good point there.
Yeah. With Van Til, Van Til combines in some ways how you read him. There's a Vossian strain. I believe it undergirds everything Van Til does, but there's also an Abraham Kuyper part to him. And so you have these interpreters of Van Til who emphasize different things. Greg Bahnsen, when he read Van Til, he would see the Kuyperian. When Bill Dennison would read Van Til, he would see the Vossian. I agree with Bill. I think Lane agrees with Bill. And I think it's grounded in a philosophy of history. And I believe that's the key to understanding the connection between Van Til and Voss, in that eschatology presupposes a philosophy of history.
Yeah, that's definitely there. That's significant. But the thing about it is that some of the Van Tilian interpreters haven't always seen that thread. and it causes great harm to your understanding of what of his theology and his apologetic. Because if you don't get the Vossian import in a two-age eschatology that is coursing through the veins of everything that Van Til does, you're not going to understand anything. I was talking to a professor who teaches apologetics at a seminary very friendly to NAEPARC, and asked him about, you know, what he thought of Van Til's use of covenant and the role of covenant within Van Til's apologetic. And he said he didn't really even think it was that important of a feature. I about had a heart attack. I don't understand how you miss that if you read any of Van Til. But Voss is all the way through that, through his works. And if you miss the Vossian import in the biblical theology, the two-age eschatology, the antithesis, the federal representation of Adam and Christ and what that means, you might as well just close up your books and go do something else.
Yeah, I totally agree. Lane's more of a, you know, expert on Van Til than I am, but I think you even see it in just the simple title, The Defense of the Faith. That's pure Voss right there. Voss, it's the self-attesting Christ of Scripture. I know that's Van Til's term, but that's what Voss is talking about, particularly in his first book, the Pentateuchal Codes of back in 1886. That's very evident there.
Wonderful. Lane, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what stands out when I read Van Til in light of Voss's influence on him, and I think this is what makes people struggle to understand Van Til, you can think you're reading a philosopher or someone who has mastered the history of Western philosophy, which I do believe is the case with Van Til quite clearly. But what makes him so hard to understand is not simply that he understands philosophical categories that most don't. He very clearly understands the eschatological ordering of the created order to glory and the way that covenant informs that relation and what arises from the relation of God to the creature is that no sooner is Adam created in a fellowship bond, ethically inclined toward God in protological prelapsarian fellowship, no sooner is that given to him than that is covenantally given to advance. A covenant is given in that relationship to advance it to glory. When sin enters the world, what you have growing out of that is an absolute antithesis between those who are in Christ after the fall, going to be ordered back to God, brought back to God, to heavenly glory on the one side, and those who are fundamentally opposed at the core of their being to that revelation on the other side. And that, the clarity Van Til had on that, I can't see him getting anywhere but from Voss. Mm-hmm. And he's explicit about his dependence on Voss, especially when it comes to that pre-fall arrangement and covenant.
And where do we see that, Danny, in the historical record? Even if he's not quoting Voss every page or footnoting him frequently in his own writings, he spoke of him often, correct? And he obviously was devoted to him in the classroom and around campus when he was a student.
Oh, yeah, that's where Dick Gaffin is so invaluable, being around Van Til for 30 years. And, you know, basically, Voss is what they talked about all the time. And so I tell the story in the biography, that in the footnote, that Dick was writing his dissertation on the resurrection and redemption, the centrality of the resurrection, and Paul's theology, and Van Til wanted him to contribute to the Thestra, Jerusalem and Athens, and Dick didn't have time, and he kept on turning him down, and finally Van Til asked him, well, what do you have time to do? And he says, well, I think I could do something on the first chapter of my dissertation. It has to do with Voss. And Van Til just lit up and just was so excited that Dick was going to do that, and that becomes the chapter, the interpretation of Paul or whatever, that chapter is in that book. And I love the story when it's also in the footnote in the book, in that how much Charles Erdman irked Van Til. he irked him as much as he irked Machen. And he said, so Van Til would say, you know, there'd be a couple of us down in Voss's class, because after World War I, no one took Voss's classes. He was thought as a German. It's just unpatriotic at Princeton. And Van Til would say, the door, you know, there'd be a whole classroom. You couldn't get into Erdman talking about Peter the Rock, the stumbling block. And according to Dick Gaffin, it was like Van Til really was also upset about that form of preaching, which was moralistic and following the example rather than a redemptive historical exegesis of the text. Everything that they were doing in Voss's classroom, only there's only like five of them.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. This is just a question off the top of my head. Do we have indication or know anything about the preachers that Van Til grew up under when he was in Highland and, you know, Munster and Dyer area? I don't know.
I do not. Although I've been thinking about, one person I didn't put in the book was R.B. Kuiper. Mm-hmm. And I tried to be disciplined enough not to follow too many rabbit trails. But it's interesting that when Gerhardus Voss took the appointment to Princeton in 1893, Klaus Kuiper, R.B.'s father, was one of the people who was appointed to replace Voss at the school. And so that's how much R.B. Kuiper was connected to the scene in Grand Rapids. His father had been at Compton, had been close to Bobbink, had, after 15 years in the pastorate in the Netherlands, came to Michigan and was in the CRC. So when R.B. Kuiper studies under Voss in 1916 at Princeton, again, this is somewhat like, you know, someone from the old country, part of the family. So that when Machen starts Westminster in 1929, he's handpicking perhaps, you know, four of the great students that Voss has in the last 15 years of his of service at Princeton to be founding faculty at Westminster. So again, that's where you start to see this tie between the two. And I think it was just for that original faculty and stuff, you know, they all knew how much they were dedicated to Voss. And one thing that the theologian that I think is the most underrated Reformed theologian of the 20th century is Ned B. Stonehouse. Yeah. And every time I pick him up, I just can't believe what I'm reading. I mean, so there's this great article that is in the second year of the Westminster Journal on Dubilius and the relationship between faith and history. And when you read it, you're reading it through and you begin to realize that Stonehouse has combined Machen's What is Faith with Gerhardus Voss's Self-Disclosure of Jesus, and he's applying it now to a Bardian. And it is just fantastic. It knocks me out. I mean, I'm sitting there thinking, why hasn't anyone written about Stonehouse other than Moses Silva? And that this guy, everything I read, I'm sitting there going, this is what he's doing.
Yeah, he's a real heavyweight. You know, I have someday that maybe we could put together a shorter writings of Ned Stonehouse and maybe include within that some essays in his honor or you know, develop his thoughts and more historical studies. That perhaps is a Reformed Forum book waiting to happen. But what other aspects, what specific aspects do you really see in Stonehouse's work where Voss and his influence is quite evident? There's another Dutch guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. So many things with Stonehouse. But so what he does in the witness books, the witness of Matthew in Mark to Christ and the witness of Luke to Christ, is that he takes Voss's contention concerning the organic nature of Scripture, and he begins to look at them as theologians. Just like Voss said that Isaiah was a theologian, that Paul was a theologian, he begins to look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke as theologians, but he does so taking on the critics the same way that Gerhardus Voss did, because the critics wanted a detachment. You know, as soon as you talk about Mark being a believer, they want this detachment, whereas Voss you know, one of the key insights of Old Voss is when he says at the end of the biblical theology that we ourselves know that we live just as much in the New Testament as did Peter and Paul and John, is that we living between Christ's death and resurrection and his coming again, we're in the same redemptive epoch. That what this means for the believer in reading this the scripture, that if we believe that God is sovereign and that the scriptures have this harmony, then we should be even more emboldened to look at the differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, so that we might further understand the Bible. And he goes to work at it in a way that I think is really ahead of his time. And he's doing it at the very time in the 1940s and 50s when redaction criticism is coming into the fore, but they had a critical method that cut, I mean, they divided things at the core in which they could never really get to where they needed to get to.
Right.
And that's where Voss helps Stonehouse to get there, and it's beautiful.
Oh, that's well put. I mean, that's a tremendous thought. Lane, what do you think about that and Stonehouse's influence? Don't we still see that need still today?
Yeah, I mean, what I think Danny's saying that I just appreciate about Stonehouse that comes so clearly from Voss is that the methods that were being used during the time that Stonehouse was writing from the critical side were methods that gave you a kind of a mechanical view of history that precluded any kind of supernatural fellowship bond and precluded any kind of unique disclosure of that fellowship bond given the character of biblical theology. So that you can look at the same dynamic, glorious work of the Son, but you can look at it as it's given in the history of special revelation, in its unity and pluriformity, focusing on different facets of how redemptive historical revelation in the past has pushed through to its organic climax in Christ. And the liberals can't do that because they've gutted organism, they've gutted the dynamism, they've gutted the communion bond. And I think Stonehouse is, Danny, tell me if this is in the ballpark, okay? But I think his hermeneutical sensibilities and theological penetration really stand out.
Oh, but yeah.
It's unusual. Yeah.
Oh yeah, he's
very sensitive.
That, and the reason why I think that we don't appreciate him as much is that if you look at his treatment of Acts 17 and other things, he's retaining some of the apologetic of Machen.
Yes.
This is a true merger of Voss and Machen, whereas you and I are used to Voss and Van Til. Yes. And so we read him, and there's certain glitches that we say,
yeah, there are,
because Van Til has told us not, you know, to go otherwise here, but then you reread Stonehouse for what it is on regard to like these articles that appeared, yes, in the journal, and you begin to see the genius of the event and the meaning of revelation and redemption being utterly united. So yes, he is taking Van Til and Voss to the next step in some regard into doing that. And plus, since he's dealing more with the Bardians in their prime, he is taking them on in a way that Voss didn't.
Yes.
Man. Well, that's tremendous. And we see that there are extensions of Voss, you know, starting to ripple even outside of the biblical studies disciplines. You know, with Stonehouse, you definitely have a New Testament theologian, a New Testament interpreter par excellence, who's known throughout evangelicalism and throughout Reformed theology as well. He started ETS, didn't he? He was one of the founders, if not the founder, of the Evangelical Theological Society. But you know, if Stonehouse is a superb example of demonstrating the relationship of organic and periodic principles of revelation with Voss and carrying on that legacy, then we have with John Murray an excellent example of how biblical theology relates to a different loci, to systematic theology. How do we see Voss at work there in the life of Murray, and where is Murray so helpful in maybe showing us that aspect of Voss and his usefulness.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Lane in a second, but you really had, since 1929, you've had four individuals that have really shown, taught systematics at Westminster in the main, who have combined the systematics and biblical theology. You had Murray up until 1966. Then you had Norman Shepherd. Then you had Dick Gappin. Then you have Lane sitting in that chair. Now, three of those men loved Voss and one didn't. Shepherd was not enamored with Voss. And the reason being...
One of these things is not like the other. Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason being is that Voss based so much upon the covenant of works and the covenant of life, and it drove Shepherd crazy. And so Shepherd, and you would think that Shepherd would love Voss because of the union of Christ, which had been his dissertation topic, and Murray had been so indebted to union of Christ. But I'm not saying Shepherd definitely respected Voss, but he didn't love him. Mm-hmm. And it did not come through. And so, but you have Lane sitting in that chair, so I really should defer to him.
No, Danny, please, keep going.
Please, talk about Murray and systematic and biblical theology, because you're now doing what he's started.
Well, one of the things that Murray was so concerned to avoid is the tendency, Gaffin talks about this as well, is the tendency for systematic theology to dehistoricize biblical revelation. And what we mean by that is this, that the systematic theological method takes a locus approach, looks at topics, and those topics have in view the Bible as a finished product, the canon as it's closed, the two testaments are exegeted according to their topical teaching, God, man, sin, Christ, salvation, church, last thing, scripture. And Murray notes, and Gaffin points this out as well, Murray notes that if you're not careful, systematic theology can wind up moving in a direction that dehistoricizes and in that way provides an abstract conception of theology and of the theological enterprise. So Murray says we have to remember that the original form in which revelation is given prioritizes this act of creation and condescension, and God eventually, in Murray's view, he will talk about a covenant of life, but that there is this historical principle, a principle of self-revelation that moves from communion in Eden and has a dynamic, epochal, covenantal movement in view, a dynamism from the biblical text, and here's what that dynamism denotes. The history of special revelation, which is looking at the disclosure of Scripture from its historical movement, from its linear point of view, not from its topical point of view, that brings into view dynamic and mighty deeds of God that administer his kingdom and bring into view a communion bond by which the living God relates to a people he has formed for himself in a sacred bond of fellowship. Murray is so keen on that. So his point is that as you're engaging in the systematic theological enterprise, the exegesis of specific biblical texts that bring sensitivity to the history of special revelation becomes a necessary supplement in order to avoid a dogmatic and abstract approach. So for instance, the quickest way I know how to put it, what is man? You must answer that question in terms of four states: innocency, sin and misery, grace and glory, and do justice to all of them. Murray is saying if we don't do that, we're going to come away with an abstract topical concern rather than the concreteness of God's actual relating to his people in covenant. And so I think that's a very useful point that Murray develops. You see it in numbers of his works. And then I think Gaffin really picks that up and runs with it and develops it thoroughly out of Voss's biblical theology.
Right, but it's vindicated also, I think, in his Reformed Dogmatics. I mean, I'm so thankful that those have been translated. Yeah. Because there might have been time for people, you know, who don't have access to the Reformed Dogmatics just to think that, well, maybe Murray has stepped outside or he's doing something different than what Voss was doing. But now that we can read his RD in five volumes, it's tremendous to see the applicability, to see the congruence with figures like Murray, but also to see even how much Voss is applicable to our modern and contemporary circumstances. He had such foresight in addressing some really important things. Murray, definitely a tremendous figure that illustrates some important influence of Voss on the Reform world. Now, one person that's often pitted against Murray is Meredith Klein. It's not that Klein didn't like Voss. It's not that Klein doesn't like the connection between biblical and systematic theology, but it often comes down to kind of different certain people's understanding of the role of grace and works and all that stuff. Lane, I won't speak for you. I'll let you speak for yourself, but I believe we're both of a mind to think that there need not be such a great wall between Murray and Klein. And if we understand what Klein is actually doing and interpret him correctly, we can see that they're rather harmonious on many of these matters. But Klein, my goodness, if you stop and read Klein with any detail, especially a book like Kingdom Prologue, for example. We used to have a Klein Club. You know, we had Voss Group, and I also had Klein Club when I was seminary. I don't know, Lane, you don't have the Klein Stein in that room, do you? Is that downstairs in your glassware chest?
It's in my fireproof safe.
I'm not at home, so I don't have my Klein Stein.
I don't want that thing to burn, you know.
But we have these porcelain steins made. It said Klein Club on them, and they have every hyphenated phrase I could find. I put it in, and it kind of wraps around the Kleinstein, so like a glory theophany or theophonic glory spirit, you know, all that stuff is in this giant word cloud. It says Klein Club right in the middle of it.
Yeah, and we've renamed the shelf, the high shelf I keep it on, the upper register. That's where you keep the Kleinstein.
That's where the Kleinstein lives.
That's its location. Yes.
But I bring that up because it's rather evident. When we read Klein, to see the tremendous influence of Voss upon him, and it's like things just unfold before you. He had some strange God-given ability to see things in the text that many of us couldn't see. I had another person who was kind of cautiously sympathetic or cautiously appreciative of Klein, and he said a third of Klein is absolute genius. But the problem is figuring out which third. Now, I'm not so pessimistic on Klein on that regard, but I kind of understood what he was saying. Because if you come as an uninitiated person, just pick up something like God, Heaven, and Armageddon and just read it out of the blue, it sounds like science fiction. I mean, just the way he talks. But when we start to understand what he's doing and from the text, oh, this is like Voss 2.0. He just picks up right where Voss was and just goes into, you know, the new frontier with it.
Yeah, the Lane is so much more expert on Klein than I am, but I can definitely see Voss's footprints on the commentary on Job, mm-hmm. which we talked about Stonehouse earlier and what he did with the Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That's literally what Klein is doing with Job. Klein makes a statement in there, in that commentary, that in regard to, you know, these poetic utterances and these that what you have is a theology being written, and there's a historicity, but a theology, and what he's getting you to is Job is moving you along to where will you confess God to be your only good even in the middle of the night? I think it's chapter 35 or so. That's like every sermon that Voss preaches. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So when you read that Job commentary, I just think of Voss because that's what he's doing there. But the other one, obviously, is Image of the Spirit. Images of the Spirit is
one of my favorites.
Going to the Old Testament mm-hmm. with what Voss did in the New Testament with eschatology, the Pauline eschatology.
Yeah, the first chapter of Images of the Spirit is just gold. I love that chapter. It was so instrumental for me in the at least the last constructive chapter of my dissertation, soon to be published in modified form, hopefully in the fall. But trying to develop a theology of glorification, Klein was so helpful to me to understand that. And of course, he's just building upon Voss and those themes and understanding the resurrection of Christ and what that means for all the people who are united to Him, and how the Holy Spirit is instrumental in this work. Klein is certainly a significant figure there. Let's talk about Clowney. We're moving on and getting a little bit more contemporary. Klein, a big figure. Clowney as well, significant in terms of understanding how biblical theology can influence and our preaching. And I hope we can get to a point where most churches, and as churches continue to perhaps fill vacant pulpits, they start to look for this and start to get in like a nose for it, right? So that they can sniff out and try to find people that are being faithful to the redemptive historical character of the text. The text, what Clowney can teach us, and what I'd love for you to show us, is that it's not just a hermeneutic. There is a redemptive historical hermeneutic, but there can also be a way in which our homiletic, our preaching, can unfold this in helpful ways.
Yeah, Clowney, what he does. So in the 1950s, when Clowney comes on the faculty at Westminster, that's when biblical theology, in the critical sense, was at its glory, its height, but it was all descriptive. And Clowney comes along and he says, no, it isn't descriptive. You know, he's running with that statement of Voss that we know ourselves to live just as much in the New Testament as Peter, Paul, and John. And he's saying in preaching that this is the Christ's death and resurrection is your salvation. And he's bringing it to bear in a way that you're participating in what Christ has done. And so he puts that forward in his book in Preaching and Biblical Theology. It's a series of lectures done in 1958. They are published in 1961. And it's really, he's trying to take grace and glory, and he's trying to explain it to say, David and Goliath, how you can't just preach David and Goliath in the moralistic way, but rather need to preach it in a redemptive way, and how it shows forth Jesus Christ. And so that's what Clowney's endeavoring to do with preaching.
Yeah. Well, Lane, you may recall, and you as well, Danny, that for a time at Voss Group, we were actually working through a Clowney book. So there's reason for that.
Yeah.
It's helpful.
No, yeah, I love what Clowney does on ecclesiology and biblical theology, even some of his unpublished stuff. His work on the temple and other things is really profound. He's dealing with what he's doing there is he's taking a Vossian insight. And I think you talk about dissertation. Someone should probably should work on this. But Clowney understands that Jesus Christ is the servant of the covenant and the Lord of the covenant. Mm. And he's bringing them together always. Mm. And so it's an aspect of glorifying and enjoying the Lord. The first question, the catechism, in that as Lord, we owe our Savior, our King, all glory. But as servant, he is the one who has condescended that we might enjoy.
Yeah.
And Clowney's understanding that.
That's great. That's great. What do we do then with the real contemporary figures? We're getting now to people that are still with us, in many ways still active, still working. A guest we've had on Christ the Center several times is a real father in the faith to all three of us, and that's Richard Gaffin Jr., who can we point to any other person who's still living who has done more to advance the awareness and knowledge of Gerhardus Voss?
Absolutely not.
How does he, how really though, has Dr. Gaffin extended Voss's theology in his own way? What's unique to Gaffin's treatment of Voss?
Well, he understands. So in 1912, Gerhardus Voss has an article, The Eschatological Aspects of the Pauline Spirit, and Gaffin just grasps everything that means, and he runs with it. And for the next 60 years, he runs with it.
Yeah.
And it's just, man, we're also indebted to him. I mean, he set the standard, and he's not only been the scholar par excellence, but the servant himself.
Yeah.
It's not just his teaching, it's his living out of this mm-hmm. theology. And what he's meant, I mean, to all of us, I it's hard to put into words.
You know, speaking of the Foreign Missions committee that's meeting right now, he was a serve on that. He's a tremendous churchman. Didn't just think the theology, didn't just write the theology, but he lived it. And it continues to live it.
You know, I'll tell something of a little story about Gaffin that I think is it'll illustrate his work. I remember when I was in California and I took Dr. Strimple's class on the Holy Spirit, I was thinking a lot about the application of redemption. And I had a copy of Resurrection and Redemption, which I'd read maybe 3 or 4 years earlier. And I'd worked through it and thought I'd understood it and really hadn't penetrated it. And I remember going back with a kind of, how can I put this, with some seminary training behind me finally. And I read through Resurrection and Redemption, and when Gaffin got to locating the application of redemption in the resurrection of the death and resurrection of Christ, and situated the benefits of redemption as belonging to the benefactor of redemption himself, and showed that the glorification of the Son of God and his resurrection and ascension includes his justification, adoption, mm-hmm. and sanctification, properly defined according to the uniqueness of his person, so that all redemptive benefits that are given in the union bond with the by the Spirit through faith in Christ find their structure, their organizing principle in the resurrection of Christ. I couldn't believe it. It was just one of the most amazing insights.
Yeah, it just floors you when you see that, especially when you've been trained, or you just assume, you know, the golden chain kind of model of the Ordo Salutis. Yes. And then to have this biblical unfolding before your eyes, it just changes everything.
Yeah, and Dr. Gaffin would never, if he hears this, he'll be upset with me, but he's become accustomed to it, so I'll just continue to do it. That book is one of the most superb examples of carefully crafted, exegetically detailed, theologically nuanced, constructive theology that advances Catholic and Reformed doctrine. Mm-hmm. It really is. Now, he won't ever
admit that. You got to get copy that. Resurrection and Redemption.
Mm-hmm. It's just a fact. And then Perspectives on Pentecost, I don't want to get going and talk too long, but to pinpoint the fact that our union is with a crucified and ascended Christ, and our fellowship bond is in Christ by the Spirit, such that by the Spirit we are raised to heavenly places in fellowship with him. And Gaffin's presentation of the significance of Pentecost, the integral significance,
Quite amazing.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
Looking at Ryan. So Ryan, do we have any Gaffin in the store? You with thumbs up? No Gaffin. You can still buy it brand new, though. But I don't think Resurrection and Redemption was ever published in hardcover, was it? Do you know, Danny?
No. Now, what's interesting about that book is that it's 20% reduced from his dissertation.
Yeah.
When
PNR picked it up.
When Baker or Urban's
published
it,
that's right.
They asked him to reduce it by 20%. So I got the dissertation in full, and also that.
We're gonna have to fix that. We're adding to our editorial committee's work. I got a story about Gaffin and Voss a little bit. You know, we've been talking about Voss's hermeneutic and especially a two-age eschatology. And so I took Dr. Gaffin's course, Acts and Paul. It was the last time he taught the entire course. He taught one more section of it 2 years later, but he didn't teach the whole thing. So I was tremendously blessed. I actually thought this might be the last time he taught the class for the full class for the, you know, for the last time. And so I moved around some of the things in my schedule in my MDiv program so I could take this class in person. And I'm
very
glad,
wise.
I'm glad it's wise, very wise man. And so we take this, it's a 4-hour course and we've gone through the entire semester and we come to the day of the final exam. And before the class started, we were over in the library, many of my friends and I, all studying away. We've been reviewing our notes, copious notes, for several days in preparation of this exam. And, you know, at this point in time, you're just kind of going over, you're over it. You're hopefully not learning anything new. You're just kind of reviewing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So another classmate came up to me and he looks down at my notes and he sees a diagram, and it was a overlap of the ages. It was a diagram of the already not yet. He goes, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, it's a diagram Dr. Gaffin used to describe the Voss's two-age eschatology, the eschatology, you know, of the New Testament." The guy goes, "Huh?" He goes, "You think that's going to be on the final exam?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that's going to be on the final exam." And he goes, "Oh, can I borrow those notes for a few minutes?" And I said, "Sure, brother. Study away." We had about 15 minutes to the test. So then
that's
after
the way my worst nightmare begins.
I know. But after the test, he comes and finds me in the library. He's like, "Hey, thanks a lot. That was on the exam." I don't want to know his grade, but there you go. Maybe that guy, I hope, never forgot. Voss, two-age eschatology, probably going to be on the test in a Gaffin class. There you go. Anyway, well, that brings us really to the end of at least many of the figures we wanted to talk about today. It's been really fun, but we've got plenty of time to talk about other questions and whatnot. So we've got a chat room open. Again, a reminder for those who are listening after the fact, as this comes out as an episode of Christ the Center, this has been a tremendous time to do this. But we wanted to do this as a very special thank you to many people, people that have come to the VIP dinner, special supporters of Reform Forum, several of them, as well as the people that have purchased the hardcover book directly from the Reformed Forum store online. We're so thankful. We know many people did a pre-order and bought the book. A lot of them, you know, there was a deal going on, but then there have been other deals out of our hands that have arisen, you know, through the Westminster Bookstore and other places where you could have saved a few dollars had you waited. And I honestly felt a little bad about that. It wasn't our intention. We didn't set those prices. We're thankful that people are able to get the book at a reduced rate, but I also wanted to do something extra special for our early supporters and for the people that really wanted to get this book and that signed up even before having seen it and paid and ordered the book. We hope that you haven't been disappointed. I know I can't imagine that you would, but we can't say enough about the book and Danny's work and his scholarship and also in how the book turned out from the printer. But this has been a thank you for all of you, and I want to take the time now even just to say again, thank you so much. Thanks for supporting the work here at Reformed Forum. We love doing what we do. We can't believe that we get to do it. And you make it possible. And by making this possible, we pray that more and more people will come to know about the deep riches within the Scriptures and that more and more people come to know our risen and ascended Savior, Jesus Christ. So that's what we're about. And this night has been about that. But we want to open up the floor now for folks who might want to ask a question. We see several people have a virtual hand raised. So I'm told in the chat room that there's an option for you, an ability. There's been some confusion because this was supposed to be a webinar, and I tested this last week. Things didn't necessarily work out, and this started as a regular meeting. But I still see people are able to raise their hands. So there's one of two ways if you're watching live, listening live. You can either raise your virtual hand, and I'll unmute you, and you can introduce yourself after I call on you and ask a question. The other way is if you don't see that virtual hand and you still want to ask a question, you could just chat in the group chat, and I'll keep my eyes on that. But the first question I saw is coming from Adam T. McNeil. I'm going to lower your unmute you and lower your hand. Adam, you there?
Yep.
Hey, how's it going, Adam? It's good to talk to you.
Doing well, yeah. Thanks for having this available.
Absolutely. It's good to see you as well. We got the video running. Hey, so what's going on? What are your thoughts on Voss?
Well, I was hoping to ask what was probably an impossible question, but if anyone can handle it, it's this group. So I'm just thinking through Voss, at least in the Eschatology of the New Testament article from ISBE, taking that majority reform view on Romans 11, 26, that the mass conversion of Jews before the return of Christ. But then Vossians like Ritterboss, well, not Ritterboss necessarily, but Bavinck and Ritterboss and Gaffin and Clowney and others taking that more nuanced approach of, at the risk of being simplistic, elect Jews and elect Gentiles who are the Israel of God coming to faith up until the parousia. Mm-hmm. So I guess my impossible question is, how did the Voss disciples have that more nuanced approach than Voss himself perhaps didn't, at least in the Eschatology New Testament article, if that makes any sense?
Danny or Lane, you got to take a stab at this one. It's a significant question.
Yeah. It's a fantastic question, and it's stated very well. So the ISBE article is in 1915, so it was probably written around 1913 or so before it appeared. I do think Adam represented Voss correctly. I don't know, if it was. I guess I would take a look at Birkhauer actually to see what he says. And my gut says Birkhauer might have been a person there, but I don't know the answer.
Lane, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I really, it's not something that I've given detailed attention to. I could speak out in terms of my instincts, but I don't trust them. I don't want to say something I can't say myself either.
And regrettably, this has been something kind of on my list of things I'd like to study various interpretations on those passages, and it's been
a
many years.
Question, Adam. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, Camden.
I'm just saying it's been many years since I've really spent extended amounts of time on those texts in this regard, and so I'd like to nuance my own view, and I'd like to study that and see the differences of the exegetical views of those figures. But you've given me something to add to my own reading list now.
Yeah, the only thing I can recall is maybe 20 years ago reading a paper by Lee Irons on the subject, but that's been at least 20 years ago or somewhere in there.
Yeah, the non-millennial interpretation of Romans 11. Yeah. In my mind, Adam, I'm not able to give you a kind of reconstruction of what would make interpretations differ in those who are ordinarily going to be following Voss, or moving in terms of the same kind of conclusion that he would on a particular text. I don't know. Sorry, brother.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said, it's an impossible question, but just
maybe not. We've got homework now. So that's
good. A good one.
If anyone has some thoughts, you could write some comments, people even listening after the fact, feel free to comment on the website. We'd love to follow up and hear it. But thanks for your, I'm going to be one of those radio DJs. Thanks for your question, Adam. We're going to go to the phone lines. It's good to see you, Adam. Thanks. Have a good
thanks,
one.
Thanks, brother.
The next hand up I saw, at least the virtual hand, Kelly Kraft. I'm going to unmute him. Hey, Kelly. It's good
hey guys,
to talk to you
again. Doing?
How are you?
Doing well. Doing well. I wanted to ask maybe Lane, Dr. Tipton, and about Voss. Very appreciative of his biblical theology and how influential it's been. Even in contemporary days in Reform circles, we see a renewed interest in biblical theology. Hmm. And while recognizing his brilliance, maybe my particular question is, are there any ways in which, you know, being almost 100 years after Voss's main works, how and what areas do you think we can still improve on his work? And maybe a particular area of question I would ask you and for your insight is in Voss's biblical theology, he moves from Moses, and he has a section on prophetism where you guys are at now in the series, and then to Christ, but he kind of eclipses David, and David's the narrative and the whole covenant there in redemptive history. And I just wonder maybe if that's one area in which you know, if Voss could extend his work, in which he would maybe do more work in, or if you have any other insights in which we can extend Voss.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking about, and then I want to punt the David question in terms of the structure of biblical theology to Danny, see what he says. I've got a thought or two, but I think his will be better than mine. But in terms of the question, I think one of the things that it struck me recently that needs to be developed is the integration of Voss's, some of the things Voss is doing with his theology of the Trinity and the divine person of the mediator need to be more organically related to the history of special revelation, or to covenant more specifically. So for instance, to give you an example, if you read through Voss's dogmatics, he has an amazing discussion on the relations of the Trinitarian persons. He talks about subsistent relations. He talks about relations of origin. He talks about relations of coherence. And out of those categories develops, I know we're not talking about his influence on Van Til right now, but out of those categories develops a lot of the Trinitarianism of Van Til. Van Til's following Voss and Bavinck and some of the Princetonians. And so finding a way organically to integrate the theology of the processions, the theology of the missions, and bring a more full Trinitarianism into relation with the eschatological aspect of the Pauline conception of the Spirit, for instance. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think is a wide open field for Vossians and Vantillians to develop. I'm personally interested in doing that. So I wouldn't want to say that there's anything I want to go back and fundamentally change in Voss. I think he's fundamentally right. I think now is a time for a kind of flowering of what Voss has written on in terms of both the dogmatics on the one side and all of the wonderfully robust biblical theology on the other side, seeing those in more organic interface with one another, from the processions to the Visio Dei. That's a wonderful kind of broad-ranging project. And right now, my mind is turning to some of those Trinitarian issues.
Well, Danny, we had spoken because we'd received another question through the Facebook page several weeks ago about some apparent holes in biblical theology, like why Voss doesn't treat certain eras of redemptive history or certain features at great length. And there could be historic reasons for that, correct? I mean, why does it appear that Voss might be heavy in some areas and not on others when there doesn't appear to be a direct, obvious theological or, you know, interpretive reason?
Yeah. Well, one of the great things about having Machen's notebook is you begin to realize where he dates the classes, how much he has to scramble.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, he's writing so much and you're sitting there thinking, you know, I don't know if anyone ever lifted up their head in this class, as much content there. You know, this is, I mean, it's amazing he squeezes in so much that he does, but it's the fact of the matter is these are class notes that get, put into book form. And I guess my guess is, and I'd love to hear what Lane has to say, or Cam, you have to say, but I've always thought he was just kind of going along Acts 3:22 through 24 in regard to what's said there, and he's expanding upon it. That's was always my guess, that Acts 3 was why it has the structure it does, and you don't see like a more treatment of David there.
Yeah, Danny. That. Oh, wait, Camden. Did you want to speak to that?
No,
okay.
I didn't.
Danny. The. Sorry, I didn't want to jump in. You know, I'm getting excited, but I think that. See, the deep structural insight that the biblical theology gives on this particular topic, that I think would be a surprise to even some of the listeners of the Voss group who hadn't read that up, you know, that section before we treated it. It's that you have a kind of incision that brings about the substance of realized eschatology in its earlier typical form. So yeah. As we've been moving through Voss's biblical theology, we've noted this principle that there's kind of an internal escalation in the process of redemptive revelation and the organic progressive movements. And here, I think Voss just opened up a horizon that will include, but within its parameters, supersede David altogether.
Yeah. See, I like that.
So David, it's almost as though, however high David is, given the fundamental movement Acts 3 brings into view, David must, in the nature of the case, be superseded in this prophetic movement. Mm. Yeah. So something in that ballpark. That's helpful, Danny.
We've got some other questions. Thanks, Kelly, for that question. That's pretty provocative in a good way, thought-provoking. I've got two more virtual hands raised. Feel free to raise your hand if you got another question. But before we go to the hands raised, we got a question from Robert Cardona. Apologies if I'm not getting the pronunciation correct, but he writes in the chat. He says he's having some issues with the microphone. So he writes, within the context of influence, given Voss never joined the OPC, and yet he had such an enormous impact and influence on it, What would have the impact or influence looked like if he did join the OPC and left Princeton? Presumably also joining at Westminster. I realize that's a hypothetical and maybe difficult to answer. What do you think about that? We're going to have some sanctified historical imagination, Danny. What do you think would have been, have been different in this alternative universe?
Oh, I don't know if it'd be much different. What I think is that Kuyper and Van Til and Murray and Paul Woolley and Ned B. Stonehouse, they improved upon Voss in that they had Machen's ecclesiology, that conviction. And Voss did not have, you know, he did not have the courage to do what was needed. Now, I think by 1936, he was frail. And I understand that. I would hope he would have done it in 1929. Mm-hmm. But I think that that what they combine the theology of Voss with the ecclesiology of Machen, and so in that regard, you know, one of the interesting debates that you often hear is should you go? So let's say there's an OPC in a certain place, two OPCs, and one of them the preaching's better. Or they'll put it this way. There's an OPC and there's a non-OPC in a town. And one of them, the OPC, the preaching's not as good as the non-OPC. Where do you go? And I think that the Van Til, Murray, Stonehouse answer is you go to the OPC.
I think I'm with them.
The policy answer is you go to the better preaching.
What happens when the preacher leaves?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But so that's at least the way I think of it.
I think it's a great way
to put it.
I love
that answer, brother.
Yeah.
Go to the OPC. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead, Camden.
Oh, I thought you were taking off with something. That's good. No, I appreciate it.
Well, I actually do want to take off with something, if you don't mind, just quickly.
Fire away.
This is hypothetical, so we can have a little bit of fun, just a teeny bit.
Like my for you, this it's the equivalent of 4 a.m. for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
my hope would be that if Voss had gone to Westminster and into the OPC, you know, my hope would be that maybe theonomy would never have been born.
Oh, wow.
No, because yeah. I would hope that bringing that, what kills theonomy, just kills it, is the pre-redemptive eschatology of the covenant. You can't, you know, you just, you cannot be theonomic if you understand the prelapsarian order and then the typical character of the theocratic kingdom. Mm-hmm. Voss is just, it's there's no hope for it. I doubt it would happen, but my hope would be that there would be such a strong redemptive historical, amillennial, covenant historical, God-centered, heaven-oriented focus on the ascended Christ that theonomy would look, you know, like something that's deviant from a high eschatological ideal. And so I doubt it would have happened, but I would hope it would have maybe made the OP even more inculcated against that sort of thing.
Yeah. Maybe. Interesting thought.
Who knows?
We probably got time for two more normal questions, maybe a couple of quick ones if you have some more, but we're going to go to Jeff Lynch. We know Jeff. How you doing, Jeff? You there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can see you too.
Hey, brother.
How you doing?
Very good. I apologize that you can see me.
Ah.
This question is not a deep theological question. This just has to do with the joy that I had in reading this book. Oh. And Danny, I wanted to, first of all, thank you. Beautifully written. I love your blending of his theology and his life, which sort of makes sense because his theology was who he was.
Amen.
But, I got pages 18 through 20. You talk about the Mosaic origin of the Pentateuchal codes. And it just sort of blows my mind that a man in his early 20s, I believe, could produce a polemic work of this majestic nature. It's incredible. I realize I'm guessing that you read a lot more about this in your research, and obviously you can only fit so much in the book. Could you add to my joy and just talk about that a little more and maybe share some further thoughts on it?
Well, thank you for the kind words. It is amazing that he wrote that at that age, and that's it was the best critical takedown of Briggs and Wellhausen, and it's a 23-year-old writing it. And what became apparent, and I kind of, my guess is that this is really when he started to develop the positive aspects of his teaching of biblical theology, because he realized how much the critics were missing the boat. So it was not only he was looking at them and thinking how much they had gotten wrong, but it was also forcing him to think, you know, what is it then positively, you know, it should be said. And but it doesn't mean it's easy reading. It's really hard reading. I mean, I outlined the whole thing. I outlined everything he wrote except the reviews. And with the reviews, I outlined probably the 10 I thought were the most important. And I probably had to read this book maybe 4 times, even in outline. So I kept on wanting to think, you know, in terms of if I had to boil it down to a few pages, what would I say? And you have to, and you begin to realize that even at 23, he's a professional theologian. So he's going to spend so many pages turning over every stone. And but I just, the thing that really stood out to me was that the critics believed that there had to be a later editor or redactor in order to make things cohere. And Voss was saying, no, it's a sovereign God who makes things cohere. and he is the one who is in control of all things. And he's also saying, because you do not acknowledge that, you are never going to understand what's going on in the Bible. You have no faith commitment, and there must be a faith commitment. And so the very things you are ruling out are the very things that must be presupposed. And this is where Van Til builds upon Voss to the nth degree, and Nebbi Stonehouse builds upon Voss. So it's sort of like reading the articles on the prophets in the 1890s. You have to read like 20 pages to get, you know, a page or two, you say, wow, you know. So that is why those are not popular readings, and they're pretty obscure. But if you persevere, what he says when, you know, and the way I think of it is, all these critics, they have no value anymore. And he was pointing out why they should have no value then. But then he'll say something positively, and you're sitting thinking, this could have been the article in and of itself, and how we probably would have written it today. And so in that sense, I think going back and rereading him is always a value there.
No, that's good. Thanks, right, Jeff. Tremendous question. We've got another online, Caleb Shea. I know I've been talking to Caleb over the email a little bit. Let me unmute Caleb. Caleb, you there?
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great. Good to see you.
Yeah, thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, I know you've been waiting to ask a question. I'm dying to hear it.
Yeah, I've been itching.
Yeah.
So I know that the Voss family has enjoyed a pretty rich legacy in the RPCNA denomination. I know, starting with J.G. Voss. Did Gerhardus ever comment on his affiliation with that denomination? And in particular, did he ever comment on the historic covenanter belief in national covenanting? I think that would be there's some interplay between Gerhardus' view of Israel and their view on national covenanting. So just was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
No, not as far as I can tell, that he never commented on that. And I would be shocked to the nth degree if he had any sympathy whatsoever with that view.
That's kind of what I figured.
Yeah.
Could you, expand on that a little bit, maybe for folks who might not know the reasoning for that, Danny? Why would that shock you?
I think that his amillennialism is so extreme that I think the covenanter position lends itself to a post-mill position. Mm-hmm. I think in that view, although the younger RPCNA individuals both have maybe 20 years ago led Thou 8 being repealed and have done other things, have been, I think, very encouraging, but as far as that aspect, I would think that it lends itself to a post-mill view.
Sure. Lane, you have any thoughts on that one?
I really don't have it in detail. I talk about Voss's view of the theocracy and explain, you know, in detail why I think it would not move in that direction. But I don't know the detail. I'm not aware of a good answer specifically there.
Sure. Yeah, there might be something to review. I don't, you know, Danny would be the one to know. But I mean, the way you could find out is continue to look through the letters and any other possible correspondence. But Caleb, have you found anything with JG, for example, that might be interesting, even if we can't make any connection to Gerhardus?
No, I haven't found anything. There's something that I've wanted to pick up for a while is history of the Scottish Covenanters.
Mm-hmm.
JG's, and just see if he has anything to say about his father in there. But
I'd like to check that out myself. So if you come across something, let us know. If you don't follow up with us, we'd love to hear it. It's an interesting subject. Yeah,
I think that Voss was so very appreciative of the pastor he had in Santa Ana. He was very, very thankful for that. I know that J.G. went to Westminster Seminary in 1938 for his master's after that year of sabbatical in 1937, where he was back in California. And so I think there was a deep appreciation for on Voss's part, at least from what I can, you know, reading between the lines for the tradition. But in regard to those particular aspects of the tradition, in the way I would read his eschatology of the Psalter, I think that there would be, he would not follow his son on certain things there.
Yeah. I think we can cover about two more questions. We've got actively two hands raised, and we could follow up another day. So this doesn't need to be the last time we do this. This has also not only been a special thank you for all of you, but kind of in a way an experiment or a trial run to see if we might be able to host more virtual events down the road, do a few of these a year. I think it'd be fun. I'd like to do it, but maybe we can cover different topics in the process. But we got a familiar face to the folks that come to the Reform Forum Conference, Mark Goddard. Hey, Mark, how's it going? You there?
I'm here. Yes, it's going well. I guess kind of a basic question that on biblical theology, it seems like whenever discussions of Voss and the subject come up, there's people that come back and accuse him of being a liberal because he's talking about biblical theology, and that's supposedly owned by the liberals mm-hmm. or Hegelian or something. When we're going through the book, and it's clear that he's not with the liberals, but if you could just give any comments on that.
Mm-hmm. Was there any reaction to Voss, Danny, early on, perhaps, or even later, just by engaging in the very discipline of biblical theology? How much work do you think he had to do to distinguish himself from that?
I don't think he had to do much work. I think, particularly being at Princeton, the stronghold of orthodoxy, and his being siding with Warfield. I mean, best friends of Warfield, and so I don't think that was something he had to battle. I think that Dick Gaffin probably had to battle a little bit more, particularly in the 1970s when Dick was writing some of those great articles in which he wanted to rename systematic theology, things like that. So I think he probably had to deal with it a little bit more. Lane, would that be your read also?
Yeah, that would definitely be my read as well. And I think I will say this. I do know that there are some who will note that when Voss is talking about redemptive organism, that he can use language that might sound to some untrained ears like Hegelianism or some kind of,
synthesis Neo-Hegelian over time model. Or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if you look, if you read Voss, he's so trenchant, very similar to Van Til, so trenchant in critiquing all forms of historicism, so clear-minded in penetrating the critical categories that he was dealing with. Just, for lack of a better way to put it, just read the self-disclosure.
I think the thing is that if you talk about Voss and his reputation during his lifetime, think of the three guys that stood by him so firmly. William Green recruits him. You couldn't have, after Charles Hodge's death, William Green was the standard for conservative Presbyterianism. Then B.B. Warfield, and then J. Gresham Machen. I mean, you couldn't put three more. I mean, those are the three guys you would pick in the Presbyterian Church for 50 years, and they're all standing beside Voss. So I think his personal reputation was in that way. He didn't really have to deal with it.
Very good. Mm.
Let's go to Adam, and then Bob Tarullo, of all people, snuck in. So he wants to ask a question, too. So we got time. We got time for Bob, of course. Adam, I'm unmuting. I don't have a last name on the username, but Adam, can you hear? Are you there?
Yep.
Hey.
I can hear. Can you hear me, guys?
Oh, hey. He's been hiding.
Hey. How you guys doing?
Adam. It's Christopher.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate what you guys
beard,
are doing
brother.
So much. Yeah, thanks. Hey, I had a question. I'm curious about what your thoughts are on who would have influenced Voss homiletically. I mean, his sermons in Grace and Glory are so unique. They have such a distinct quality to them. Who do you think influenced him homiletically?
Great question. Yeah.
I would say his dad. I mean, that's the one I would think is his dad.
Are sermons of his dad, like, available
I doubt it.
That'd be a gold
mine. Oh, okay.
Yeah, but his father was one of the most well-known CRC preachers, both in the Netherlands and in the U.S. And there are accounts. Now, I don't read Dutch, and that's probably one of the weaknesses of the book. So there's Dutch accounts of his father that I wasn't able to get to or didn't take the time to translate. That would probably be my guess. I mean, some people, you know, thought, you know, Hengstenberg had an influence behind, but I think that's just a reach. I think it's actually, if I had to pick two people growing up in the Netherlands, it would be Herman Bovink's father, Jan, and his dad. But his dad,
okay,
not ordering.
That would be something if we ever could find those sermons. And something to look
that
for.
That would be fascinating.
There's such a tremendous heritage and a strand of redemptive historical preaching and you know, development of biblical theology within the continental churches, and particularly within the Dutch tradition. And I'm thankful for a lot of the brothers I've been getting to know in the URCNA through Mid-America Reformed Seminary and people that are out there. And so we're hoping to do more of this work and connect with more brothers outside the OPC, of course. But, you know, Voss, of course, obviously picked this up somewhere. And if he got it from his father certainly didn't grow and develop as a theologian or preacher in a vacuum either. So uncovering this history, this tradition, would be really, really something else. Perhaps we can, you know, do our historical work with an eye toward that. We might be able to find the answer someday.
I think that Lane might agree with me on this. Lane's been preaching through Ephesians for what, like the last 10 years? I go up and hear him once a year, and we're like four verses ahead. my least favorite sermon of Voss's is the oldest sermon he has from Ephesians, and it's the spiritual resurrection of believers. And that was done in the 1890s. It's my least favorite sermon of his because it seems so ordo salutis to me in a way that's not really like his later sermons. And I wonder if just being in the chair of biblical theology and just maturing, that he starts also to develop his own style in regard to preaching. That I have no way of proving that, but that's just a guess or a gut feeling, perhaps.
Good point. Well, Adam, I'm going to mute Danny for a second. Go Blue. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Sounds good. Go Blue.
Great to see you, buddy. We got one more. We're going to go to Bob. Bob Tarullo, who is the host of one of our podcasts, Theology Simply Profound. Bob, are you there? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. And we see you, too. Hey, Bob. How are you? Glad you could make it.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking the time for this. Yeah. Adam actually stole my thunder a bit. The question I had was, aside from Kuiper, Bavinck, those connections, who would have been Voss's mentors, the guys who influenced him most? I was thinking homiletically as well with Adam, but theologically, in his piety, things like that. But aside from those two that are out there already, Kuiper and Bavinck.
That's a good point.
Yeah, well, I think in addition to his father, it's his uncle, Hendrikus, who actually becomes the full-time professor after that first year, once they get four men to fill in for Voss at the theological school in 1893. His uncle takes over for the next 5 years. And his uncle is a major figure, had really been standing opposite Abraham Kuiper in Amsterdam in the late 1870s. And so I still think that those were two, you know, along with the Bovinks, are the people. And I think that you have to understand that growing up, the CRC, they are so poverty-stricken that it's sort of like the OPC at its beginnings. So they just have each other. I mean, I think they grow very close. And in Voss, I think some of the most revealing things he says in his letters is he had opportunities to go back to the Netherlands. He didn't. And I think he's very truthful in that he doesn't want to return to that poverty. You know, and that, and it's, and in some ways, he's almost, I think, a little guilty about that, that he, on the one hand, believes that American religion is deeply flawed by its materialism and its just surfaceness. On the other hand, he likes the fact that he's not starving.
Yeah.
You know, he likes that.
Good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Danny.
Yeah. That's a great question. Thanks, Bob. It's always good to, talk to you. Wow. There's been a lot going on, and there's been a lot of things that we've been able to cover tonight just in this, I guess it's been an hour 42 now. So we've been going on for a while. So I just want to take the time again to thank everybody for joining us. And it's been tremendous. This has been fun. We hope we can do more of this in the future. And for those of you who are listening after the fact, who are listening to the recording, of course, you can continue on the conversation either through Facebook or Twitter. You can also put a comment directly on the website under this episode, and we'll try to get back to you and engage in the conversation that way. But thanks so much for joining us again, Lane. Danny, it's always a pleasure. You can't say enough.
Just a wonderful time.
And of course, the book, Gerhardus Voss, Reformed Biblical Theologian, Confessional Presbyterian. There are many copies still available. Might have to do a second print run soon. The copies, you can find them at Amazon, the Westminster Theological Seminary Bookstore, WTSBooks.com. You can find them at RHB. You can find them overseas. We have the Reformers Bookshop in Australia, New Zealand. And, of course, you can get it directly from our store as well, both in hardcover and in EPUB copies. So if you want to get in touch with us, send us a note over at mail@reformedforum.org. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.